We're talking about canning and food preservation here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer. Ken, thanks for being here. You probably have come across that statistic about how we waste nearly 40% of the food we buy. Food waste, huge problem in our country. And one way to address the waste is by canning. And it just might become a new hobby, making preserves and salsa and being proactive when the garden throws us too many tomatoes. So how do you preserve your fruits and vegetables from your garden or from the farmer's market? Has food preservation become a tradition for you? Do you share your canned goods as gifts coming up at the holidays? We're at 800-642-1234 for you to join in. Christina Ward is a certified master food preserver for Milwaukee County. She teaches classes on canning and preservation techniques, and she's the author of a book on the art and science of food preservation. She joins us from our Milwaukee studios. Christina, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. It's so nice to speak with you.
Well, before we get into the process of canning and the methods of canning, what are you currently doing in your kitchen? What are you preserving these days?
Well, I'm very excited because I think folks sometimes think that preserving is just canning, but preserving can also be freezing and dehydrating. So I'm working on two big projects, which is when the cherries were in season, I didn't have time to can them, so I froze them. But now I can take those and make a cherry pie filling and can that up and getting ready for the holiday season, as well as the apples. It's apple season.
Yes,
and so
it is.
I've been buying a lot of apples, and this weekend's big project is going to be making some various apple products and can those and put those up for the winter.
Okay, so there's some bourbon apple thing you got going on.
Isn't that great? So when you're making...
tell us more.
Yes. When you're making a jam or jelly or a pie filling, a lot of times you can start playing with the recipe a little bit as long as you keep ratios the same. So in the case of adding some alcohol, which is a fun thing to do, it adds a lot of flavor. And in the cooking process, the majority of the alcohol cooks off. So it's not like, you know, you have to worry about a breathalyzer at breakfast. So, you know, you can add bourbon to cherry and make a bourbon cherry jam. Or, you know, one of my favorites is doing like a bourbon apple pie. If you use in the recipe, when you're making an apple pie filling, just thinking about when you even make it for the pie, you make essentially a slurry, you know, that to make it thick.
Uh-huh.
And if you substitute some of the water or apple juice for bourbon, there you go. You've got bourbon apple pie and it tastes great.
Oh, wow. I love that. It just gives it an extra pop, something that's unexpected.
It does. And, you know, as we think about sharing our harvest with the holiday season, gift giving, it's always when you add your level of creativity, whether that's inside the jar or even outside the jar, now's the time to start thinking about those things. Because then people are always like, holy smokes, I didn't know you could do that. Thank you.
And it's so from the heart. Do you do anything special with your labels on the outside of the jar?
It's so much fun because they make it easy. They, meaning all the wonderful creative folks in the world. And you can buy your own just blank labels. And if you have an inkjet printer, Photoshop is pretty accessible, as well as some of the basic word design label programs. You could make your own. If you're an Etsy shopper, the craft marketplace shopper, there's some really talented folks who have created labels that you can purchase to use. So it allows for a lot of creativity that way, as well as using some external jar decorations for the old-fashioned simplest, just getting the old-fashioned red and black bandanas and putting
cute.
That over the top and tying a little bow around it really just makes a difference and kind of zhuzhes it up.
Talking with Christina Ward, she is a master food preserver for Milwaukee County. We're learning about canning. What questions do you have about canning, fermenting, preserving, dehydrating foods. She's game for all of it. Is food preservation a tradition you've passed on in your family? Who taught you to can? What's your method? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Christina, I know we're going to touch more on apples later, but what crops are best for canning this time of year?
This is the time of year to start thinking about root vegetables in the vegetable realm. So the things, if the markets are coming towards the end of the season, some, unfortunately, the farmer markets have ended, but some go through November. So now is the time to think about those root vegetables and the few cruciferous vegetables that are actually better after they get a little bit of cold, like Brussels sprouts.
Uh-huh.
And so if you pick up nice Brussels sprouts, those are ideal for pickling. And you can have your Brussels sprouts all year round. Cabbage. So now's kraut making season. So pick up some cabbages. You can start making homemade sauerkraut, which is a fermented product. You can then further freeze it or can it or fridge it, but that it starts as a ferment. You can start making that. We have to think about two with fruits. We've got, of course, the apples, pears.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few more select growers, especially in southern Wisconsin, that are experimenting with quince. And if you keep your eye out and ask at the orchards, you might be able to get a few quince and, of course, cranberries.
So would you make like preserves out of quince? Like, what would you do there?
Yeah, quince is a really ancient fruit, and it has a delicate flavor, floral, in a way. People often describe it as being similar, as if you took an apple and a pear and mashed it together. The quince itself isn't really edible as a fruit because it's very hard. But if you cook it and make a jam out of it, or you can extract the juice for a jelly, it makes a really wonderful, delicate preserve that a little uncommon here in Wisconsin, but again, becoming more common as growers are trying to propagate more trees.
I love my aunt's preserved beets. What can we do with beets? Those are one of my favorites.
Now, this is where we think about the science of the food preservation, especially with a lot of the root vegetables like beets, parsnips, the rutabagas. They're really thick and dense mm-hmm. cellularly. So it's not something we can just throw in the hot water bath canner. So you've got two ways to preserve your beets. You can freeze them, of course, and you can can them. If you're going to can them, you have to either use a pressure canner. That's a little bit more difficult, not because it's a more of a machine-based preservation technique, or we can pickle them. And I know a lot of folks have fond memories of pickled beets.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can do those savory, with a regular, just nice, strong vinegar-based garlic and garlic pickling solution. Or a lot of folks, especially if you've come from a German pickling tradition, use sugar, and they're kind of a sweet pickle.
That's the one I love. Yeah, the sweet pickle. That is definitely me. So you mentioned the pressure canning method. There's also the boiling water method. Is that right?
There is. The two methods. So hot water bath canning is used for products that are essentially acidified. And that's the technical term for anything that when you've made it, you've raised the acid level. And when you're making a pickle, you're essentially putting something in an acid bath. So you're raising the acid level of the food. Raising the acid level helps slow down and prevent pathogens from moving in. And when you're making jams, jellies, and pie fillings, things like that, salsas, you don't necessarily think that it's being acidified, but it is. There's always lemon juice added to raise the acidity level. So that's used for hot water bath canning.
Well, let's pause right there as we talk about canning and food preservation with master food preserver Christina Ward. What questions do you have about canning, fermenting, dehydrating foods? How often do you try your hand at canning or preserving? How has it worked out? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. We're learning about food preservation here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kahn. Thanks for being here. Modern canning was invented by the French in the early 1800s. It's a way to feed the soldiers in the Napoleonic Wars. But then fast forward to today, and here in the States, we're all about food in cans. Preserved foods help make our weeknight meals tastier, faster to whip up, often more wholesome. How often do you can or preserve food? What's your go-to method? Is this a year-round hobby? What are your favorite foods to can? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Master Food Preserver Christina Ward is with us, and she is our guide. Christina, we're talking about method there as we work through the methods of canning and preserving. Help us understand the equipment we need or should really use to get started with the process of canning if we haven't done this before.
Getting started doing hot water bath canning is easier than ever. You may remember seeing an old speckled pot in your grandma's kitchen. And now most of the major grocery stores sell something called like a canning discovery kit. There's many different brands. And it contains what's really the critical items is a basket. You don't want jars touching the bottom of a pot. And they come with a silicone basket and a jar grabber. The grabber being the technical term for it's a tool that you can with a circular bend to it that allows you to put jars in and out of boiling water. And those two items together help turn any kind of taller stock pot into a hot water bath canner. That's all you need to get started. And of course, like any kind of hobby, you can spend a lot of money if you want to. There's people who will sell you very expensive things, but you can get started for quite cheaply. Pressure canning, on the other hand, is a little bit more expensive because, again, there's a specific tool, and that's the pressure canner. And so that you can't fake. You got to have a pressure canner to do pressure canning.
Yeah, and so there are these, I was looking at all of these pressure canners, and I thought, that's an investment. I don't know if I should take that step, because that's certainly another thing in the kitchen as well.
It is. It's definitely something that takes up a little space. There are a few items that there are combination pressure canner, pressure cookers, so that can be dual use. But always make sure that if you're going to go that route, that it says it's a pressure canner and cooker, not just a pressure cooker. And the difference is you're looking for this thing that controls the pressure. And there's a lot of kind of colloquial canning terms like a jiggler, but you need to be able to control the pressure. And that's where we get away with some of the modern electric, what they call the kind of the instant pots.
Mm-hmm.
Those don't necessarily have a way to control the pressure so that you can't use those for canning. But the old fashioned cook kind you can get for as little as about $50, and they can get upwards for really high quality, giant size ones up into almost $500. But again, it is the necessary tool if you're going to do anything that is not acidified. And then when we come back to our beets and your carrots and rutabagas, if we want to preserve those canned in just a water solution, they have to be pressure canned.
Let's go to Ken now, joining us from Beloit. Hi, Ken.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. How are you in canning? Is the question.
I love it. And I was just calling to hopefully maybe encourage if there's any men listening that do this, because sometimes we think that this is a ladies type of a job, but I love it. I do jellies. I've done green beans and carrots this year. And my wife knows how to treat her man. She bought me a brand new pressure canner this year. So I have that, and then she buys me the beans and the carrots, and I've done pepper jelly and crab apple jelly. And
so, Ken, what's your specialty?
Well, I guess I don't know if I have one or
you
not.
You dabble. I can tell.
Yeah, I do. And I've got some beets here. I've made pickle beets already this year, and I'm thinking I'm going to make some more. So, it's not hard at all to do. You follow the instructions, and like your guest was saying, you can go out to any of these stores and get a pressure canner. I think we got ours at Farm and Fleet, and it works great. You just follow the instructions. It comes with a book. But well, I've been doing it for years, and I just love it.
Well, Ken, it is great to talk with you, and thank you so much for calling in on that. Christina, you hold classes of people, you know, on teaching techniques. Do men show up in your classes?
Absolutely, and I was so glad. Thanks, Ken, for calling in, because more and more folks are realizing the health benefits and the actual fun. Anytime we take kitchen to hobbies, you know, some people do experience, you know, great joy in not just making food for others, but actually understanding and connecting with their local farmers if they're buying things at the market, and just enjoy the actual process of doing it. It's a great hobby. And yes, I'm finding more and more men are embracing it because it requires a little bit of a technical skill too, and a little challenge. And again, easy, but still, you know, you have to think about it. So it's a fun hobby to get into.
Let's go to Christy now in Madison. Hi, Christy.
Hi.
What's your question?
My family's always been one that always froze things, and I was the first one that started canning in my family, and I taught myself to can. And since then, I've now taught my mom to can, my friends to can, my sister to can. So we have canning days where I have what I call a three-butt kitchen. And so we have people come over, and we have a day where we take the kids out, we go pick the items, and then the next day we have the adults in the kitchen canning. And it turns out to be a really fun day with all of friends and family just making things.
Oh, wow. It's quite the enterprise. I love it how you've really spread it around.
Christy, it's so good to hear that you've essentially resurrected a 100-year-old tradition. In farm communities and smaller rural communities, people did work together. There was always a community canning day because, again, many hands make light work. And so folks would always share that load and then share the benefits. So if one person was growing green beans and one person was growing tomatoes, or when the strawberries all came ripe, because you don't remember how strawberries always come ripe so fast, is if you work together, you get a lot more done, and it's a lot more fun, too.
We're talking with Christina Ward. She's a master food preserver. We're learning the ins and outs of canning. How do you preserve fruits and vegetables from your garden? Have you ever tried a canning recipe that didn't turn out well? What happened? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Christina, let's return to those apples, 20 pounds of them in my porch. If we were going to make applesauce, what are some, what's a good batch of applesauce? How would you proceed?
Applesauce is, I would actually, with that many apples, you first thing you'd want to do is kind of do it almost a triage on your apples. Pull your best ones out and eat those first. And if you were thinking about making any other apple items, whether it's an apple jam, an apple jelly, or an apple pie filling, you want to pull out the better looking apples. And so if you do have a couple bruisers or, you know, kind of fallen apples, those are the best ones for sauce.
Okay.
The other thing that's really good for sauce is a couple different varieties. It adds more flavor. And so once you've kind of culled out your bruisers, you want to clean them and trim them. And what we mean by trim is take off any of the bruised spots. And with good applesauce, as long as they're clean, you chop them up and you throw them in the pot with a little water and start cooking them down. Folks will use different methods to get different styles of applesauce. Some people will peel and core them. I don't, because you've got a lot of flavor and nutrition there. After you've cooked down your whole apple mush, you run it through a sieve to remove any of the cores or the seeds or, you know, any of the other bits, and take that reserve, that kind of apple mush, and then you can sweeten it as you desire. With applesauce, you can sweeten it with honey. You could use some maple syrup. You can use brown sugar, white sugar. Follow the recipe, which there's some really great recipes available from the state of Wisconsin for free from the University Extension Service. If you go online and just kind of Google Wisconsin canning recipes, you will find hundreds of safe tested recipes with many variations on applesauce. But that's the basic way to get started.
Yeah. And so after we made the applesauce, then the canning of the applesauce, what would you, I mean, because, you know, the applesauce, cooking it down through the sieve, that's been a little bit of a labor there. How can we get that and get to that end, preserving it for putting it up in our pantry?
Right. And when you have, when you finally have the applesauce tasting exactly the way you want it, and it's been properly acidified, again, that's adding a little lemon juice, you then prepare your jars, which is hot soapy water. A lot of times there's that myth that you have to boil jars, mm-hmm. and that's left over from the days when farm folks were making their own soap. If you have a dishwasher, that's great. Run them through the jars to the dishwasher. That gets them clean enough. Hot soapy water, rinsed well. And then you fill the jars to the prescribed amount. There's another canning term called headspace. And we're mostly familiar with those two-part lids. You put a flat lid on, a band, lightly tighten, and then you put it into the hot water bath, that boiling water bath, for the prescribed amount of time. Why I'm not telling you exactly the time is because those things can vary, and that's where you check the recipe. It'll always have the exact instructions.
And we're going to go here to a news update. Christina Ward, our guide on canning, right here on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Right now we're talking about canning food from the fall harvest. We're getting tips and recipe ideas along the way. What are your favorite vegetables to can? Do you want to try to can something and you need a recipe idea? Share with us, 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. And Master Food Preserver for Milwaukee County, Christina Ward, is our guide. Let's go back to the phones now. John is joining us from Richland Center. Hi, John.
Hi, good morning. I am going to ask your guest, how does she pickle fish? My recipe takes a week and a half.
Okay. Can you go a little bit into your recipe first, John? Like, what do you do in that week and a half?
It's 2 days soaking haddock and onions in brine. Then you go 2 days soaking them in vinegar. Then you make famous brine, which has got brown sugar, dill, and salt, and sugar. Brown sugar, hopefully. And then you soak it for a week.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, Christina, what are your thoughts there?
I always laugh a little bit. I can help here, but I'm allergic to fish. So know that my experience with the fish recipes is only theoretical. but what it sounds like you're doing, it's very much like a fermented fish in the Scandinavian tradition. And even if it's not, when you're using a vinegar to help, you know, accelerate that fermentation versus just, as we think about fermentation, as just kind of catching wild bacteria, what you're doing is acidifying that fish. And then the sugar helps pull out some of the moisture. And so my thoughts on it are, if you're keeping it in the refrigerator, that would be the only thing that you do have to really kind of watch out for, because when we're acidifying, is what we're really doing, we're just slowing down the potential for bacteria. We're not stopping them entirely. So making sure you're doing that process in the refrigerator will sure help keep that your fish safe to eat and make sure that nobody gets sick.
John, how long have you been pickling fish?
Well, I just survived 61 winters in Wisconsin.
Okay.
And probably since I graduated from college.
Yeah.
And John, is that a recipe that was handed down to you through your family?
Well, actually, I pulled it off the internet.
Ah. Sometimes we have to be careful a little bit about kind of getting recipes from the internet, because food preservation, if you do it incorrectly, you can essentially create an environment for some pretty nasty germs that can make people really, really sick. So we always want to be careful to use recipes that are tested. For fish recipes, I highly recommend looking at actually the University of Washington and the University of Alaska. Both of their extension services, given their proximity of their fishing industries, have some great canning and food preservation recipes for fish. Also, the Center for Home Food Preservation, which is located in Georgia at UGA, acts as almost a clearinghouse for as a consortium for all of the universities to help share their canning and food preservation resources. So I would double check there on the ratios of the vinegar that you're using to sugar, just to make sure that you're keeping it safe.
Wonderful tips. John, thanks so much. Let's go to Chris now in Madison. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What's your question?
I kind of have a two-part question. I was wondering, one, how does one become a master food preserver? And two, I know there's classes on high acidity and low acidity canning certifications. I was wondering how to find out more information about those.
I will answer both of those questions for you. Those programs are run through the University of Wisconsin. I'm going to answer the second one first. The classes that you're referring to on the certification for high acidity are for folks who are working under what we term the pickle law. So recently, Wisconsin passed a number of what they kind of called cottage food industry laws that allows home producers to sell at farmers markets. And there are some very specific rules about what you're able to sell, as well as then some caps on dollar figures. But we encourage, we meaning anybody affiliated with the university extension programs, highly encourage anybody thinking about doing that, selling under the pickle law, to take one of those acidification courses. And again, that information and the schedule, if you look at the Wisconsin Extension Services or DATCAP, the Department of Ag Trade Commission, they will have the schedule of those classes. As to the Master Food Preserver program, the program certification itself has been on hiatus. There was a number of budget cuts coming in 2010, and that is one of the programs that kind of got cut back. What I would welcome you folks to do who are interested in becoming a Master Food Preserver, and know that yes, there's a lot of skill involved, but it's also really about what we're doing today, which is talking about the safety and the most up-to-date science techniques. So if you're a master food preserver, your responsibility is to share your information with your neighbors and teach classes and act as a resource for your community. So if you want to be an MFP, be ready to be a volunteer.
Kind of like those master gardeners.
Very much so. It's like they're all born out of that same Wisconsin IDEA initiative.
How long does it take for canned food at home to go bad, or does it expire? What should we be looking for?
The general recommendation is 1 year. So 12 months, that's what I always say. Put the date on the jar when you make something so you know. But again, there's that window between 12 months to 18 months. But after that, it's not going to go bad necessarily, but it's not at its optimum. And so we always caution folks to use good common sense and inspect your jars. So if there's any discoloration to the outside of the jar, meaning that if the contents of the jar don't look the same way as they did on the day you canned it, then you should be suspect. If there's any kind of black, gray, brown, any color mold that looks like it's in the jar, do not eat it at all. Or if that lid, when you pop the lid, it should be really tight. You should need a little can opener to get the lid off. If it just kind of falls off, that's usually another sign that something went wrong, and do not eat that food.
Is it oftentimes where something goes wrong in the sealing process, or where might be the breakdown in the process?
It could happen in a number of places.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And so what I always recommend folks do, if you follow good process at the beginning, if you're really scrupulous about making sure your canning process, which is the filling of the jars and when you wipe the rim and you put the lids on and you process in the hot water boiling bath canner or in the pressure canner, if you're really
disciplined about doing that correctly and not taking any shortcuts, you will always have the most rate of success for all your jars. It's when folks start to get a little careless and, you know, are taking shortcuts that you can end up with problems.
We're talking with Christina Ward. She's a certified master food preserver for Milwaukee County. She wrote the book Preservation, by the way. Has food preservation become a tradition for you? Do you have any recipes that you have passed on for generations? Do you can foods and give them away as gifts? How do you do your labels? We're at 800-642-1234 for you to join in. Christina, pumpkins. You know, October, lots of pumpkins around. Are there ways to preserve pumpkins?
Absolutely. One of the things that you'll start seeing is, you know, kind of pumpkin spice everything. And as well as the as well as the like pumpkin butter. Pumpkin butters are a little bit problematic. They always have that asterisk of it's not, it's one of the things that you should not try to can at home. And again, there's a, the reasons are it's very cellularly dense, and we just can't do it safely yet. If you're buying it in a commercial sense, you know, say, if, you know, if you're at the grocery store, commercial canneries can get their temperatures much higher and make that food safer. So don't try to make pumpkin butter at home. But what you can do is can chunks of pumpkin. And those are, you would do with a pressure canner. So just, you know, clean your pumpkins, chop them up in nice uniform shaped little chunks, and put them in a jar with the water and follow your pressure canner instructions and follow the correct processing time. And you can find that, again, on the State of Wisconsin Extension website. And you'll have canned pumpkin chunks. You can take those chunks later and then make it, you know, pumpkin butter exactly when you want it. Keep it in the fridge or freeze it for a bit. Or have those that pumpkin ready to go, whether you're going to stuff your turkey with it for Thanksgiving.
Pumpkin pie, maybe?
Pumpkin pie to puree it for that. So, yeah, there's lots of options. There's always a way to preserve a food. It may not be exactly the way you want it, but you still have to follow the science.
So when you get those cherries out of the freezer this weekend, you'll have to thaw them first. You know, when you're taking something out from the freezer to start the canning process, what does that look like?
So what I'm going to, what I do when I'm preparing is, because most recipes for jams and jellies start at a basic, like using about 4 cups of fruit. So I cheat a little bit by always freezing things in 4 cup measurements.
Nice.
So I know if I'm taking out a freezer bag, I know it's already 4 cups. And then I'm going to defrost that just in the at room temperature if I'm going to use it the same day. If I'm starting to take it out in the freezer in the morning as I'm ready to work in the afternoon, or you can freeze it or defrost it overnight in the refrigerator. And once it's defrosted, don't throw away the liquid that may have seeped out, because that's very good, too, to put in your jam and jelly.
Talking about food preservation with Christina Ward. She's the master food preserver for Milwaukee County. What is your favorite tradition about canning? Do you can with a family member or friend? Share your food preservation traditions, your questions, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're spending the hour on canning and food preservation here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Canning was once the thing that we looked to our grandmothers to do, but canning is making a big comeback. We're learning all we can with Christina Ward. She stays with us. She's a master food preserver for Milwaukee County and taking your questions. Let's go to the phones now. Chris in Neenah. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Nice to talk to you guys.
Good to talk with you. Thanks for calling in on canning. What's your situation?
I have a question about sauerkraut. So I like to make kind of the traditional sauerkraut fermented in a crock. And you can eat it, you know, for 6 weeks afterwards, and it stays pretty good, and it's nice and crisp. But I was just wondering, for keeping it longer so you can enjoy it throughout the year, what your guest recommends is a way to kind of put it up so it still stays nice and crisp, but you can have it just on the shelf for you know, to be able to keep it longer, how to go about doing that?
Thanks for the question. I'm a sauerkraut maker. And this is one of the situations that I mentioned earlier. There's always a way to preserve something, but it may not be exactly what you want. So if you're looking for something for shelf-stable sauerkraut, you would have to take your kraut, put it in a jar, and process it in a boiling bath canner. De facto, that's cooking it, and so it's going to make it less crunchy. But so your best way to keep your kraut crunchy would be to freeze it. That way you're going to have it, and still it's going to get a little softer because freezing too will break down some of the cell structure. But your crunchy kraut for the maximum amount of time would be for freezing. And then you could, you know, optimum about 6 months or so. Know that too, okay, that if you keep your crock, or if you move it into jars and put it into the refrigerator, you might get longer than 6 weeks out of it. Because refrigeration will slow the fermentation down, and so it'll stay kraut-ier longer.
Thanks so much, Chris. Let's squeeze in Joe in Beloit. Hi, Joe. What's the situation there?
Hi. I've been canning for years, meats, jellies, vegetables, love it. My favorite part of it is going down in the basement and looking at the shelves of all the different jars with all that hard work throughout the year. But it seems like in the last few years, when we make jelly, when we go to open up the jelly, there's just a little bit of black underneath the lid. And we can't figure out what we're doing wrong, and we're wondering if it's our wet limestone basement and it just encourages microbial growth or mold growth. But something seems to be going wrong the last couple of years with a lot of our jellies.
Are you talking about the screw band or are the actual lid?
The actual lid, yeah. The jelly still looks fine. Everything looks great. But when you pop open the lid, there's just the tiniest bit right in the center usually.
Okay, so
some kind of mold made its way underneath the seal, I guess.
Well, let me first caution you, because anytime you see mold means there's millions of little things that you're not seeing. So
we don't use it. My wife won't let us use it.
Thank you.
I would probably use it, but she wouldn't.
Smart lady. I would suggest just kind of an off troubleshooting is, It's not really the basement, because you have to make sure your ceiling, it should be sealed. So once it's coming out of the canner, if it's sealed correctly, nothing should be getting in. So it's not really the basement. So I would double check your process. Make sure that, one, you are, you know, wiping the lid, making sure that you have the correct headspace on your jelly, making sure the lid's put on, the band is put on, and your hot water bath processing it for the correct amount of time. Those are the elements that would potentially cause a mold to get in, because what's happening is it's not sealing. If mold is getting in, that means your jar is just not sealed.
Okay. It still makes the pop noise like it is sealed. It's really befuddled us, and it's just the last couple of years, it seems.
Yeah, and you know what? That's a really great thing to bring up, because sometimes the pop noise is just a noise. It's not really an indicator of the seal.
Okay.
And if you look at the lids, they are either, you know, kind of pop up a little bit or go down. So unless the lid feels like concave, like there's a dip in it, then it's not sealed. So regardless of how much popping you hear, so don't listen for the pop.
Don't be deceived by the pop.
Look for the visual inspection to make sure that the jar is sealed.
Well, Joe, thank you so much for calling in with that. And Christina, you have just fielded so many great questions. Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much. It is always my pleasure and my great joy to talk about food preservation.
Christina Ward is a certified master food preserver for Milwaukee County, and she teaches classes on the techniques of canning and fermentation. She also wrote a book on the art and science of canning, fermentation, and dehydration. It is called Preservation. That came out in 2017, and she joined us from our Milwaukee studios.
Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with the answer to a Wisconsin question about polka.
We recently received a couple questions from listeners about Wisconsin's love affair with polka, like this one.
My name is Josie Dunn. I'm 10 years old, and I'm from Mineral Point, Wisconsin.
She asked,
how did the polka become a dance and a tradition?
And when I think about polka in Wisconsin, I think of one guy. Second-generation Wisconsin and International Polka Association Hall of Famer, accordion wizard, and bandleader, Steve Meisner.
Hi, this is Steve Meisner, and I am a full-time musician living in Whitewater, Wisconsin, the land I love.
And here's Steve's quick answer.
Well, it started in Bohemia, and then the dance is invented, okay? And so that was spread throughout Europe as a dance, and it was, in its day, like rock and roll.
But Josie says she'd like to know a little bit more.
Because I know the polka is important to Wisconsin because it is the state dance, and I want to know a little more about it.
Steve?
It's woven into the fabric of our lives in this state. It's really in Wisconsin because of the rich European heritages that are in Wisconsin.
Okay. Like?
It spread from Bohemia,
Poland,
Czech Republic,
Germany,
Switzerland,
the Alps region,
the Dutchman style.
The
Polish style is completely different.
Whereas, like, the Slovenian style, or what I call the American Slovenian style that I do, is more melodic and has more of a swing feel.
Ah, okay. So, but what about the dance?
The Polish hop is the most prevalent in Wisconsin, which is part of the original that's from the old country. But, like, if you go to see Dutchman and Czech bands, you'll see more of the older folks doing, like, the two-step foxtrot, you know, sort of stepping with the polka versus the raucous, you know, Polish hop style, which you'll get more with the Slovenian style and the Polish style.
But what's the learning curve on the whole dancing part?
Just let me just say that, you know, a lot of the people that want to learn that weren't raised with it, learn, you know. But for the average person, they just get out there and they just jump around. The greatest thing about polka music is it's forgiving. You know, like even my grandkids, I mean, they just love to get out. As soon as they hear the music, they just start getting a little bouncing going, you know, and they just want to get out there and do it.
So just how important do you think polka is to folks in Wisconsin?
It's very, very important to them. We have regular places that we play it all the time that are, you know, in certain areas like the Hiawatha Bar over in Sturtevant, and it's a part of their lives every month. If they miss a dance, they feel bad, you know. I've had generations of college students come out to Madison and say, "We came back for a reunion. Do you remember us from 10 years ago, you know? And we danced here all the time. We were here every time you played here." And I'm like, "Yeah, sure, I remember you guys."
So how does it feel being a Polka Hall of Famer from Wisconsin?
Yeah, it really is an honor because I'm hanging right there with my dad, of course, and Frankie Yankovic. And, you know, I mean, it's been a part of my life, my whole life, you know? So, I mean, truly, it's an honor.
And a little open to for you right here in Pulaski, Wisconsin, with Steve and the boys. Thank you very much.
This story came from audience questions as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Colbert.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.